Ignition sequence start. 3, 2, 1. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Welcome back to University, everybody, the podcast where we explore the hard-hitting questions of Earth, existence, and the unknown. I'm AJ Perrin, and I'd like to turn off the monitor so I don't have to look at myself the whole episode here. All right, sweet. That's much better. This week, we're going to be talking about the Artemis Accords. I'm sure plenty of you guys have heard, if you're following along on our Instagram, that this is what we're talking about. So with the help of seven nations, in 2020, NASA created the Artemis Accords. Judd, I was like, why is he giving me this look? I haven't said... With me, as always, is...
Yeah, I'm waiting for my introduction, Judson Martin.
There you go. You get the gist of it. NASA created the Artemis Accords in 2020, and they're hoping to create a sustainable system for the future of space exploration. But somehow they managed to fit this whole document in just seven, not even whole pages. So let's dive into exactly everything that they're covering in such a short document.
Yeah. We'll start it off with some news. What's going on in the world?
Let's rip into it. I've got some good ones. Where do you want to start? It's up to you.
To start off, we're going to talk about the Mars sample return mission. So NASA is planning, similar to how they did on the moon, they're planning to go get some rock samples from the Martian surface like they did on the lunar surface.
Right.
So this mission, the cost of this mission right now is estimated to be at $11 billion.
At the high end, to give them some grace. But $11 billion is a lot.
I'm not saying that it isn't worth it, but it's very expensive. And so this was about $5 billion larger than the original estimate. And the reason it's cost so much is they're going to use multiple launches that go along with this. There's multiple spacecraft needed. So it's a pretty big endeavor, but nonetheless, they're getting a little scrutiny from the government for spending so much money on this, so much more money than they had originally.
Understood said. Scrutiny, I think.
Yeah, I mean, $5 billion, yeah, it's a little bit.
Perseverance has been collecting samples on Mars since 2021, which seems like it was just a year ago, but it's actually 3 years ago now. And not only do they have to launch a rocket off, let's say they do this in one fat trip, right? They do it all in one shot. That would still mean that they have to launch a rocket, no problem, we've done that before. Send it to Mars, okay. Land the rocket in order for it to be reused. Collect the samples, right? So get the equipment on board the space shuttle autonomously, because I'm guessing they're not planning on having anybody go with. And we have to relaunch it off the Martian surface, fly it back to Earth, and then land it on Earth, which is harder. It's harder to land on Earth than it is on Mars. So there's a lot of challenging steps in the way of us getting those samples back. And I'm not going to lie, what we find in these samples better be really interesting for it to be worth that much money and that much time. The one thing we didn't mention is they're planning a 2040 timeline. They can only go so fast because, one, they need to spread the budget out over multiple years, and two, they need to have a portfolio of other projects going on at the same time. They can't just drop everything and make this our only endeavor, because then they'd have no output for the next decade or so.
Okay, sorry. I was reading into the Mars sample return mission here. So the idea here is there's five different spacecraft involved in this mission. So there is the Perseverance rover, which is going to collect the samples and then put them in a cache.
Has collected the samples, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's going to be a retriever, which is going to go grab the samples. And so as a primary, there's a sample retriever lander. And so I'm guessing Perseverance would bring those over to the lander, and the lander would take them back to Earth through the ascent vehicle, which is going to be the first ever spacecraft to launch from a different planet's surface. And then it would return those samples back to Earth. As a secondary, there is the sample recovery helicopters based upon the successful Ingenuity helicopter. And these would be a secondary way to get the samples from Ingenuity to the ascent vehicle.
So they're going to go have another helicopter pick them up and bring them over?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I think based on this, there would be another object in orbit called the Earth Return Orbiter. And so this would be, so the ascent vehicle is going to take the samples from the Martian surface up to the orbiter. They're going to dock, put the samples in the orbiter, and then the orbiter is going to go back to Earth.
Yeah, makes sense. Just kind of like the Martian, the movie.
There are a lot of steps going on in this mission, so maybe 11 billion makes sense.
They think the mission's too complex right now as they have it, so the latest breaking is that they're calling other space companies and whatnot to hear their ideas and proposals to try to reduce the budget and get it closer in terms of timeline. Let's hope those samples have signs of Martians so that it's actually worth it. Anyway, let's move on in news. We've got a new Boston Dynamics robot. If you pay attention to Boston Dynamics at all, they make the humanoid-looking robots and the dog-looking robots that are running around hydraulic-powered. Now, this new one is fully electric as compared to the older models, which means it's stronger, and it also has a greater range of motion because the hydraulics, while they're really powerful, also limit how far you can move each of the limbs because there's other pieces that they're going to knock into. There's also a huge fat camera in place of the face of this robot. It almost looks like that one character from Apex Legends. I don't really play that game. Pathfinder.
Yeah, I've seen.
Is that the name of the is that the name of the robot?
Yeah, it is.
Isn't that also the name of a Mars lander? Pathfinder. It was the one that was in the Martian movie.
I don't know if it's a... Oh, yeah, it was in the movie.
Huh. Well, anyway, coincidence. So it's got a big, fat camera. So it's actually going to be used in industry using what they call digital twins. If you're unfamiliar with that concept, that's when they take basically a factory and not only do they map it, make a computer 3D map of it, but also everything in the factory is almost kind of linked together. So you can monitor the factory remotely. So see where certain objects have moved in the factory, see the where things have gotten in the process, basically monitor everything. That's why they call it a digital twin. And so now these robots are going to be linked to the digital twin so they can be part of that ecosystem. I work at Collins and they have robots even right now in the factory that will carry stuff to and from different parts of the facility. And they're kind of freaky. When they're approaching a doorway, they'll say, "Approaching doorway, please stand clear." And then, or they'll get in an elevator and they have to take control of the elevator and you can't get in with the robots and stuff like that. It's kind of wild. Anyway, ripping through more. I was going to say a piece about SpaceX launching a new Starlink mission. But then I was like, I see these articles all the time. How frequently does this happen? Well, just in 2024 alone, SpaceX has launched 40 different Starlink missions, all with close to 20 or more satellites on each. So it's not even a big deal anymore at this point. They just send them out, you know, more than one a week. So
the idea is to have them over the entire Earth pretty much at all times. So there's going to be a lot of those things.
It's going to happen. If you've seen Guardians of the Galaxy, they're going to link up together and create a force field around the planet, and then nobody's going to be able to leave.
Stop the big spacecraft from coming up.
Exactly. What else we got? DART mission. If you guys remember, months ago we talked about NASA deflecting the asteroid to test, you know, a space or a Earth defense technology. They're saying that some of that debris from the collision could end up hitting Mars. Not that that matters because there's no one there, we think. But
One day,
thought that was interesting.
We're going to have people up there, so we can't be hitting that.
By the way, if you look up DART mission on Google, I love when they do this. A little satellite will fly across your screen and hit the corner and then tilt everything.
Oh, really? Is it like the asteroid that you...
The Chicxulub crater or whatever? Yeah. One article said they hit the asteroid so hard that it changed its shape. I'm like, yeah, I'd hope so. You know, you just shot a rocket at it. It's going to make a dent. I don't know why so many people were going crazy about that in terms of, I didn't think that was very newsworthy, whatever. Judd, you got another one?
Yeah. So just today, actually, I saw an article about Tesla Cybertruck being recalled. So they've put out about 4,000 Cybertrucks already at their new Texas facility, but there was an issue with the accelerator pedal getting stuck. So that's something that you don't want to happen.
Yeah,
so,
typically.
They recalled those 4,000 vehicles, and this issue was caused during the manufacturing process. It's pretty common to use a lubricant to cool down your, for a CNC machine, for example, you'll use something as a lubricant to cool the, and a lubricant and a coolant to cool down and kind of slick the surface of the part that you're machining.
You're saying when you're cutting a piece of metal, you have to keep that metal cool, so you're spraying it with stuff constantly.
Keeping both the material and more of the tip cool as well because...
Yeah, it deforms when you're cutting.
So anyways, they used soap for this, which is a normal thing to use, but They didn't do a great job of cleaning the soap off of the part, so the residual soap was left on.
Oh, it's like gunky?
And not really gunky, but it's like, it's the what moves the pedal back into place is there's a friction part that grabs onto the part to like press it back up.
Mm-hmm.
And this part was slippery.
Oh, so the opposite of gunky. It couldn't get a hold of it. Huh.
It was slippery. So it couldn't move the pedal back into place and the pedal would get stuck. So obviously that's a problem. Again, this was only 4,000 Cybertrucks, but Tesla in the past year...
How many Cybertrucks are there? I've never seen one in my life.
There's 4,000. That's all that they've made at this point.
Oh, so all of them went back.
Yeah, this is, okay, at this point.
Total Recall. Is that a movie?
I don't know.
I think it is.
Anyways, this is a relatively small recall compared to two other recalls that have happened in the past year for over 2 million vehicles each. One of them had to do with the text on a warning label being too small. That would really suck to have to spend all that money just to put a new label on it. But then there was another one that was more of a bigger deal, I guess. But at the same time, it wasn't like a mechanical failure or anything that like that. It was an update to the system for autopilot, which sounds like a big deal. But it was just to make the the warning larger for drivers to keep their hands on the wheel while they're in autopilot, which is more of just something that's like, if someone's going to ignore the warning, I feel like they're going to ignore it either way, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't matter how big it is.
Yeah, but anyways.
Total Recall, when a man goes in to have virtual vacation memories of the planet Mars implanted in his mind, an unexpected and harrowing series of events forces him to go to the planet for real. Or is he? Starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, Total Recall got a 7.5 out of 10 from IMDb. And is from 1990, rated R, an hour and 53 minutes. Sounds like my plan tonight. I totally ignored you there, by the way, while I was finding that information. Next piece of news that leads us to the Juno mission. It entered Jupiter's orbit in 2016 and has been collecting data on the planet as well as its moons. Interestingly enough, they spotted a 200-kilometer-long lava lake on the surface of Juno, and they were able to do this because they have... spectral reflection instruments on board the spacecraft that can see how reflective some surfaces are. And there's a really reflective surface, and they were like, that looks like obsidian glass in terms of its reflectivity. So they look closer, and it's a cooling lava lake with islands all over it. So
that's cool.
I think that leads us out of news.
Yep.
I'm dry. I'm
okay. Brain gains.
I don't think that's that weird. Brain gains. Yeah. So, Judd, go ahead.
So, mine today is a little more funny. It's going to get you a little laugh. So, I
don't laugh. Found especially at you.
Okay. Okay. You're going to laugh. I found an article of some interesting ways that people have died in the past. So, I think we're going to read just a few of them. Some of my favorites.
That's so sad. Okay.
In 2013, a man from Brazil died when a cow fell through his roof and crushed him while he was sleeping. You have any comments on that?
Don't got me yet. Just okay. Wondering about how the cow got up there.
It doesn't say. I don't know either.
Okay.
A lawyer was trying to prove that the glass windows that he was like defending or whatever wouldn't break. So on the 24th floor of the office building, he ran into it and it didn't break. He was right. But it did pop out of its frame and he punched his death. Oh, okay. You're laughing. Okay. That one's horrible.
I wonder if this glass broke when it hit that. What? Imagine it didn't break when it hit the pavement 24 floors below that.
I don't even know.
It's like, he kind of, last words, he's like, I told you.
Another one was
I wonder if some of these are made up. Anyway, keep going.
I don't think so.
Okay.
A jockey,
it's
a well-known jockey.
Truthnews.org or truthnews.co.
Let's not worry about the source.
Okay.
In 1923, a well-known jockey, Frank Hayes, won a race at Belmont Park in New York. While dead. So he suffered a heart attack mid-race, but his horse still carried him over the finish line in first place.
Wow.
And then the last one that I thought was pretty funny was a man who had the longest ever beard in the 1500s died over his beard when he, or tripped over his beard and died when he was running away from a fire.
Oh, man.
So those are hopefully made you a little laugh at the expense of people's death. So if you did laugh, you're a horrible person and you deserve the worst.
We can, we'll start a mini series. We've got news, brain gains, and
funny deaths.
interesting deaths. It's up to the listeners to decide if they're funny, a horrible enough person.
Sure.
My brain gains, Judd. One-fifth. I'll let you try to finish this sentence first, and then I'll give you the real statistic. One-fifth of all species in the world are what?
Let's go reptiles. I want to say reptiles. I don't know. Maybe you're taking this a whole other direction. No clue.
That's a good guess. One-fifth of the world's species are bats.
Dang.
1 in 5 species on this planet are a type of bat.
How many species of bats are there?
Look it up, man. That was beyond the scope of my brain gains, to be honest.
Okay. So you're lazy. It says 1,400, but I feel like there's a lot more species.
Dude, I'm telling you, let me...
Are bats 25% of mammals? There are over 1,300, which constitutes... Oh, of mammal species.
Oh, I missed that. Yeah, but it does say on...
And this says 1/4, but I don't know. This is on the National Park Service, so I believe it, but it's...
But it's mammals.
Yeah. This says 25% of all mammals, so even 1/4.
Wow. Okay.
So quite a bit of mammals are bats.
It doesn't mean that 1/5 of all mammals are bats, but it means 1/5 of all
the
species.
Number of species. Yeah.
Yeah. So just so you're wondering why you in 1 in 5 animals you see isn't a bat, that's because it's not about proportions here. Anyway, that leads us out of brain gains. So I say we take a quick break and then rip into today's episode topic. We got 30 minutes left here, folks.
Welcome back from the break, and now we're going to be talking about, we're leading into the Artemis Accords. And so the Artemis Accords are kind of like a collection of space laws, or not necessarily laws, but kind of guidelines for countries to follow when they're going through space exploration. But before the Artemis Accords, there was something called the Outer Space Treaty, which tried to accomplish the same thing. The Outer Space Treaty was entered into force on October 10th of 1967. This was designed by the UN, and it was kind of motivated to be put into place based on the fact that intercontinental ballistic missiles at this time could now reach into space. And so countries were getting concerned about how space could be used for military purposes and militarized. And so we kind of wanted to step away from that and think about how we could just make space a place for scientific exploration and furthering mankind.
There's a couple key provisions within the Outer Space Treaty that are covered, and there's a couple holes, I guess, that were left open that were either filled by later laws or still today nebulous about rules.
Could I get a definition, please, and maybe use it in a sentence?
Nebulous. I just use it in a sentence.
Okay.
I would say because you didn't give me details about the event we're going to tonight, the concept is still nebulous to me.
So it's just kind of like unknown. Vague. Okay.
Cool.
Yeah, that's a word I haven't heard in that.
Brain gains 2.0 right here, nebulous.
Very interesting.
Use it in your next conversation.
Wow, okay.
Key provisions. First off, outer space is, quote, the province of all mankind. Really all that means is that it's not restricted and you can't own any section of outer space. Beyond Earth, nothing belongs to anyone. It's for everyone. So also... about the military uses, it prohibits nuclear weapons in space. Key word, though, right? Which key word do you think is important there?
Nuclear.
Nuclear.
Yeah.
It doesn't apply. Well, there's other military provisions, but it doesn't apply to any other type of weapon beyond nukes. Now, let me look. Jump down a little bit further. You cannot basically do military activities in space. So you can have weapons that aren't nukes in space, but you can't test them. And you can't have military bases.
Yeah.
You can have military forces up there. Military space forces can exist, but you can't have nukes and you can't be testing weapons or making military bases.
It's interesting because actually one of the more... So a nuclear explosion gives off like a certain amount of energy, but there's something called it's a kinetic weapon, I think is... I don't know the actual term for it, but...
We talked about this in the space
kinetic.
Debris episode.
Yeah.
It just means it just like plows into it, right? No... Payload?
Yeah, and I believe we might have even discussed it earlier, but
KKV.
There's no... Yeah, kinetic...
Kill vehicle.
Something like that, yeah. So There's no payload on it, like you said. There's no like explosion that happens, but it's just a like big metal rod in space, and you drop it, and it goes so fast that the energy that it releases is actually greater than a nuclear explosion. So yeah. It's a large. It could still do a lot of damage, and that's allowed because it's not nuclear. But
yeah, I'm guessing just in the way that nukes radiate their energy, the like radius of that.
Yeah,
no. There's no explosion, just the way it applies energy is differently. But yeah, it definitely has a different amount of energy. Anyway, so the moon and other celestial bodies, another key provision here is that it's all for peaceful operations. And like I said, no country can claim sovereignty over any piece of outer space or on any celestial body. Funny though, technically Earth is a celestial body. And it says the word celestial body within those provisions. So I would argue, if I had to go to court over trespassing, I'd pull this one out and be like, the UN said that you don't own land on a celestial body.
Good luck.
I don't know. I think there's a case to be made there, but I'll pull that out when it's needed. Other key provisions. If you launch an object, you have control over that object. You retain jurisdiction and responsibility as well over it. So anything like... if it belonged to you on Earth, now it belongs to you in space. So like while you can't own land, like all your stuff is still yours. Let me back up. If I had a house or a building
On Mars, are we talking?
Moon or Mars. Let's go moon.
Okay.
If I have a building there, I retain jurisdiction and responsibility over it. Mm-hmm. So like does that mean since nobody can own land or whatever, that somebody can just walk into my house? Or since I own that house and have jurisdiction over it, am I allowed to tell people they're not allowed to be in there? Isn't that a way to get around the whole idea of owning land on celestial bodies is to say, this is my jurisdiction because it's my stuff?
I don't know, buddy. I mean, let's be honest here. Are you going to be owning, are you going to have a big real estate empire on the moon?
This is the primo real estate is happening out beyond the planet.
Okay.
Anyway, more stuff. We've got no harmful contamination of space and celestial bodies. Again, harmful contamination happens here on Earth, baby. Celestial body.
Yeah.
Feel like they're doing something wrong there. So they didn't provide any information about things like lunar and asteroid mining. So they don't say whether it's appropriate or not, or whether that falls under contamination or it's non-peaceful because you're taking it and it doesn't own to anybody, whatever. There's a gray area about harvesting resources from other planets. Some interesting points. 1976, there was an attempt from 8 equatorial countries to assert ownership over the geostationary orbit above their countries, right? Geostationary meaning it moves with the rotation of the Earth. This was shot down, but I just thought this was funny. Because it was called the Declaration of the First Meeting of Equatorial Countries, where they were trying to get a revision on the Outer Space Treaty. And yeah. I would also call that the Declaration of the Last Meeting of the Equatorial Countries.
And I would add, like, back when you were talking about...
That was a joke. That's where you laugh, because, you know, I said it was the first one, but it was also the last one, because it got shot down.
So back when you were talking about the asteroid mining...
yep.
So there has, like you said, at that time in the... Outer Space Treaty, there was no kind of provision about asteroid mining, but there was a recent one, at least in America, for American companies. They could soon mine asteroids for profit. So the Space Act of 2015 allows American companies to mine asteroids and keep the materials that they have mined.
The Outer Space Treaty gave birth to a couple subsequent documents from the UN, including the Liability Convention, which in short is just saying, if you cause a problem and it was your equipment, you got to deal with it. You got to pay for it, you know, take ownership of your actions. We got the Registration Convention, which was saying that if you're a launching state, which just means you're a state with the capability to put things in orbit, if you put something in orbit, you have to keep a list that you send to the UN's Secretary General, which includes the name, the designator of your spacecraft, the date and territory of launch, and then all your orbital parameters, which would include inclination upon exiting the atmosphere. You have to include apogee, which is the farthest point in an orbit, and then you have to include the perigee, which is the closest point in the orbit. Or you also have to say when it comes down, if it comes down. And the point of that is to say when things collide with each other or blow up or damage other spacecraft, we can trace, we've talked about this in the space junk episode, you can trace back via telescopes on the ground the trajectories of all those pieces and find out which object it came from.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's one of the things that came out of the Outer Space Treaty. And another one is the Rescue and Return Agreement, which has to do with astronauts in distress. So it applies to not only accidents that are happening in space, but also if they crash land in a territory that doesn't belong to their home country. It basically says that even if they land in your backyard, if you're a signing country, a signatory state, it's your job to go help them out. You are required to go help them out. However, you can charge the, and I guess this actually includes astronauts and spacecraft, but you're required to go help them out, but you can charge the home country any fees that you incur to, you know, go render them assistance.
Yeah. I think that one is definitely one of the more interesting ones. I mean, where was the movie The Martian? We focused only on the efforts of the U.S. to go get what's his name?
Mark Watney. Yeah. But then the Chinese...
I guess the Chinese did help out a little bit. But at the same time, where was the other efforts from the other countries?
Actually, that's the other thing, too, is that even if they don't land in your backyard, so to speak, if you can render assistance, if there is somebody that needs help, an astronaut or whatever, and you are capable of providing assistance, you are required to do so. Yeah. If you're a signing state that said, yes, I'm okay with this. And then if you're Russia, Judd, and I'm the U.S. and I have an astronaut that's in trouble and I can't for some reason go help them, it's like, you have to.
Did you mention the, like, if you want to back out 12 months thing?
Oh, no, I didn't. That was interesting. Go for it.
If you want to back out of the agreement, you have to wait 12 months, or you can back out, but then you're still in it for 12 months after you've officially backed out or whatever. So
yeah, and you can only back out within the first year. So you're at least, every country is at least required to be in it for 2 years after the signing, basically.
Yeah, and the idea is, the purpose of that is just to make sure that if you see that, hey, my satellite is going to collide with this one, it's going to be my fault, I'm going to have to go do all the cleanup.
Yeah, you can't just back out
mm-hmm. and not be responsible for that stuff. So
that's a pretty slick addition there to catch those issues.
Do you have anything else on the Outer Space Treaty?
I don't. I was just going to say that with the Rescue and Return Agreement, so with collecting stuff that lands where it's not supposed to or whatever, or helping out astronauts, you talked about in the Space Junk episode that time where, was it like a Russian spacecraft landed in Canada and scattered a bunch of debris all over.
Yeah, the nuclear debris.
Exactly. And so Canada had to clean it up. And it's the most expensive bill from one country to another.
And they
Canada.
Haven't paid all of it.
Yeah, in full. Exactly. Yeah, I got nothing else. I think we lead right into the Artemis Accords. The Artemis Accords were written with the help of 7 countries. And now there are plenty of signatory states, including all of the major
spacefaring countries.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, there's 10 main topics that the Artemis Accords want to cover. So
10 tenets, you could say.
Sure, we could say that.
Yeah. We won't probably again, though. First off, we've got peaceful purposes, which means everything that's done under the Artemis Accords and on celestial bodies is done for peaceful purposes and comply with all other international law. So that's everything that's came before it, like we already mentioned. Number 2.
Yeah, transparency. So nations are supposed to release their space policies and plans to the public so that we can make sure that they fall under all the space law and things like that.
Yeah, and you also have to share it with other nations as well. So not just within your nation, but with other nations. So everybody has to know what you're doing and why you're doing it. Number 3, we've got interoperability, which means that everybody participating has to use international standards. So whether that means you're using a certain type of measurement system or you are sending your data in a certain format, we have to develop standards or use standards and develop standards where they don't already exist so that people don't get confused and also our operations are a lot smoother. What this made me think of is with the ISS, when the ISS was assembled in orbit, right? so many modules and components came from other countries, but we were able to bring them together basically without a hitch, which is still like, if somebody told me, asked me what the most interesting piece of engineering ever was, I'd say it's the ISS, because it was assembled in orbit using tech from around the world. So
pretty cool.
Yeah, that's exactly why interoperability is important.
Next up, we have emergency assistance. So this is kind of what we talked about earlier. This is includes the rescue and return of astronauts, return of objects that were launched into outer space. And so NASA is kind of prepping for the Martian scenario there. They're trying to make sure that if that's going to happen, everybody's going to work together and try to get those astronauts home safe, and also get rid of space junk, you know, try to keep, if a satellite is being decommissioned or anything, try to either get it back into space, or like we talked about in that space junk episode, we can take it back to Earth, or we can launch it further into outer space.
Next, we've got the registration of space objects. So this goes back to the registration convention, meaning we have to continue to follow everything we've said previously about including all of your orbital data in every single thing that you're doing, so that we can trace it back and put you in cuffs when your thing collides with another country's thing. This applies not only to spacecraft. Think about the moon. If you're on the moon and Judd is one country A and I'm country B, and we're both doing our missions or whatever, Judd's over with his little stand-up push mower digging up rocks, and I'm over 10 kilometers away and I'm setting up some radio communications.
Okay, so yeah, I'm digging rocks and you're doing radio communication.
Right. Okay. I thought that was reasonable. You do the manual labor, I do like the cool tech stuff.
Yeah, whatever.
Okay, so the reason that registration is important is because if Judd hasn't told me about his vehicle, right, that he's currently operating, and we're within a certain distance from each other, we can get what's called harmful interference. So equipment that we're using might skew each other's data without us knowing about it if we don't know that those pieces of equipment exist.
Right.
So we have to keep a log of every equipment that or piece of equipment that could possibly be used.
Next up, we have the release of scientific data. So this is probably, in my opinion, one of the most important, or if not the most important, accord from the Artemis Accords. So the idea here is that we're trying to make space exploration move faster. You know, if we're working together and giving each other all the data from our experiments, we're obviously going to make progress faster and we're going to learn new things quicker. Obviously, there's also going to be issues with this, because while there's no military tests in space, we could pawn, countries will probably pawn things off as a non-military test, but it's going to have military data and they're going to claim that they can't share it. So there's going to be issues with that, but if we can overall just release scientific data to each other and allow things to happen, it's going to overall be better for everybody. And one of these planned missions that's going to take place and the scientific data will be released is the Russian Space Agency is planning on making a 3D map of the moon, and they're going to share that with everybody. So that's pretty exciting.
I think an interesting point about the release of scientific data is that while we might be sharing data in space, we still have to pay for research and research results here on Earth, because you have to, you know, pay for a journal subscription, or in one way or another, there's a transaction happens from when somebody makes research to how those results get shared. Somebody there makes money, and there's money that has to be spent. And the reason that this is bad is because in some cases, taxpayers end up paying twice. So you and I, Judd, when we pay taxes, some of that money goes to the National Science Foundation and other agencies, and then that money gets dispersed into grants that do research, right? Mm-hmm. So in a way, we've paid for research already. But then when we want to hear about the results of that research, we'll have to pay a journal to receive that information.
Right.
So you end up paying twice, which doesn't really seem fair.
Someone could profit off the back of someone else's work and that person not get any credit for it. So there's, you know, it's a complicated issue.
Yeah. It's with the new stuff in the Artemis Accords, I'm hoping that they develop data sharing standards, essentially saying if they're releasing data, don't just release the raw data, the XY coordinates, the decibels of this thing, the whatever, because nobody wants to sift through and understand that. Publish the results and what they mean in the relationships between variables, right? Not just the raw variables themselves.
The release of data will overall be a positive thing, especially for space exploration. So
yeah. Next piece would be protecting heritage. So what that means is that in the Artemis Accords, we want to protect all historic sites and artifacts, which includes preserving human and robotic landing sites, artifacts, and spacecraft. So basically all the famous firsts that you can think of. To me, in my eyes, all that I see this as is, not to diss on the U.S., but I'm like, I could see NASA throwing this in there just so they're like, please don't touch the original flag.
Yeah.
You know, like leave that standing. But in general, it'd be cool to have preservation around all the sites, like including, what was that one in February that tipped over that we were really excited for with the Columbia logo on it? Intuitive Machines. They landed that lander.
And it didn't work out.
Same thing with the Japanese one. Anyway, so they want to protect all those sites and historic spacecraft. But where do you draw the line at historic spacecraft? Because imagine, Judd, you and I finally develop our, like a rocket ship or something, and then we launch it to the moon and we land it. And then they're like, ah, man, you're the 101th landing, you know, like we drew the line right at 100. So anyway, we're going to move your spacecraft over and dig a hole here.
Yeah.
That would kind of suck. The preservation of heritage is also embedded in the Artemis Accords.
Space resources is the next one. And we've kind of talked about this earlier, but space mining is kind of the big part of this. So if we can, like, how are we going to allow space mining to occur? If a country mines space, or a company, because I think that's kind of the bigger way that things are going, is it's going to be some commercial company is going to go out and space mine and then bring the resources back. Like, this is an overall positive for humanity, mankind. We're limited with our resources on Earth, so if we can bring new stuff in, it's always going to be a good thing.
Next, we have the deconfliction of activities in space, which was the longest section in the Artemis Accords, and I guess I should have expected it, because the whole thing's about peace in the first place, so they want to make sure they know how to settle debates when they come up. So everybody has to provide information about the location and the nature of all operations in order to create what's known as safety zones. So with the safety zones, it's an area in which nominal operations or normal operations of a relevant activity or event could reasonably cause harmful interference. So they're saying stay outside of this zone, because anything that comes within it could be subject to harmful interference of some kind. In my eyes, this sounds like a not safety zone, but whatever. The thing about safety zones is they can't be bigger than necessary, and they have to be temporary and variable, meaning that if an operation is happening for a long period of time, I'm thinking on the moon here again, and the nature of the operation changes, you have to decrease the size of your safety zone or increase it. You know, like, you can't just say, we're going to be posted up over here for 12 months, just going to be, you know, intermittently running some radio tech or some whatever, and then just say, so we're going to make our safety zone 20 kilometers radius and then just, like, stay out of here. You know, that's not how it works. Or you're going to be subject to the scrutiny of all the other nations who are wondering about the nature of your activities.
Right.
When conflicts do arise, so it's kind of, in a way, when I first read deconfliction of activities, I thought, are they worried about turf wars on the moon? But in case there are conflicts between nations on the moon, you can request a consultation with that other state or any other party to, basically, they want you to sit down and talk it out. And again, these conflicts aren't like armed conflicts on the moon. We're talking about just in terms of our stuff getting in the way of other people's stuff.
Yeah.
And we want to say, no, we're doing something here. Like, leave.
Yeah. Countries spend a lot of money on these tests, and they don't want their tests to be ruined because somebody else budged into their way.
Yeah. And then we got one more key point in the Artemis Accords, number 10.
Yeah, and this is one that we've covered a lot, but the orbital debris and spacecraft disposal. If a country is going to launch something into space and it's going to have a malfunction or something, they need to be the ones to bring it back down. Or if it's going to, you know, run into something else, they need to make it change course. And if they don't, there's going to be some big issues, and they're going to have to clean up the debris from the explosion that occurs.
Yeah, it's all about responsibility.
Do you have anything else to say on the Artemis Accords?
The only thing I was going to say as a conclusion on it kind of is, so at first when I read it, I was like, oh, I was kind of surprised that it was only 7 pages. Well, this basically is just going back and referencing those documents we talked about earlier, the Outer Space Treaty, the Rescue and Return Agreement, the Liability Convention. It's just referencing those things and building on them. But I guess I'm not surprised anymore. The one thing I would say is that when documents like this are created, like, big documents that are supposed to guide future activities, you can never really predict the problems that actually will be the most significant. So we're really just guessing at this point as to what we want to make sure we cover in our first preliminary agreements. But we're going to have to go back and change them eventually in hindsight.
Yeah.
To me, it makes me think of like when nobody, I don't know why this is the example I always think of, but when people were designing cities in the US, nobody was building those cities and thinking like, oh, we should really be careful about urban sprawl. It's like there was nothing around in the US at all. And they just said, let's just plant a city here and see where it goes. And then later we're like, oh, we should have controlled how we spread this out or built this section up. Or nobody knew about that until now.
Yeah. I mean, that sort of leaves you with an idea of maybe this Artemis Accords won't work out, or maybe we did it wrong or something like that. But to kind of give you maybe a sense of peace in that respect, we have done things like this before. So there is a such thing called the Antarctic Treaty, which applies to Antarctica. So this was signed in December of 1959, so quite a while ago, and it's been regarded as the most successful international treaty. So basically, it's doing the same sort of thing. Like, a lot of the articles are the same as the Artemis Accords. It's saying that is a natural preserve devoted to peace and science. And so this area just applies to the area south of the 60 degree south latitude line. And it's been the most successful international treaty. So
they're basically treating Antarctica like a other planet.
Gives you hope for the Artemis Accords that they will work out.
Yeah. It also makes me think of, we talked about this last summer, which is a long time ago, but when we talked about the ozone layer, it makes me think about how we had the agreement to stop chlorofluorocarbons from being emitted from products and old refrigerators and stuff like that, so that now we've started healing our ozone layer because of that agreement. So it's like things like this can be successful.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all we've got for the Artemis Accords and space law. We hope you enjoyed. I've picked up quite a few interesting stories that complement these space laws, and I've stashed them away in our episode list. So we'll be hearing much more about some of this space law history in the future and some of the weird stories that were a result of it. But I think now's a good time to jump into our listener shout out. This week's listener shout out's from Elijah in California. Elijah says, although I'm not a STEM major at all or really have any interest in being one, I enjoy interstellar things, and I find the fact that AJ and Judd can simplify some more complex parts of whatever they're talking about is a really large pull for me. I can still have a good understanding about what they're talking about and keep up. And his special message is, nothing much, just keep up the good work. Smiley face. Elijah, sweet. Thanks for reaching out, man.
Yeah, thank you.
That is all we have today. I feel like it's... Come on, man. Wrap us up, Judd. Get us out of here.
Yeah. Go follow all the space laws. You know, don't break those on your mission to Mars. I know everyone's going to be heading out there soon on their, you know...
Yeah, sorry to bash your moon...
Commercial space flight.
Sorry to bash your moon real estate dreams, but you can band with me to join the cause against the celestial body harming and the celestial body land ownership clauses.
If you do need an investor for your lunar real estate empire, just let me know.
Yeah, with all your capital, your expendable capital.
Yeah.
All right, guys, take care. We'll see you in 2 weeks to talk about another topic we haven't even decided on yet. Until then, keep being curious. See you later.
Peace.
Hey, listeners. I'm sure you think my voice is a little bit different right now, but that's because I'm recording this after the fact because I didn't know if we'd be able to do it for this episode. But as I'm sure you've noticed, we've got new music brought to you by our good friend T.O. from the UK, one of the coolest British rap producers right now. We're really lucky to have partnered with him, and if you want to hear more from him, make sure to check him out on Spotify. We'll be sure to link his music in our link tree attached to the episode. Also in big news, in a couple episodes on June 3rd, University will officially become Pocket Science. I know a lot of you shared your enthusiasm about the new name, so we thank you for that. We know some of you will miss University, but it's still the same great show. You guys are just the true original listeners now. And also, now I don't have to explain to someone you need to put a hyphen in our name to find us, so that's a pretty big bonus.
Ignition sequence starts. 3, 2, 1. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.